written, so watch it be told. People around town talking this and that, how we sound like so-and-so when
the... Yo, check one, two, this is Flavor Flavor, Public Enemy, and you're listening to CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the T.O.P.
This is Mary J. Blige, and you're listening to CKUT.
Cinema Politica invites you to the theatrical release of Silvicola starting from March 22nd, with opening weekend screenings followed by a Q&A with award-winning director Jean-Philippe Marquis. At a time when the planet's old-growth forests are threatened as never before, Jean-Philippe Marquis has crafted a dazzling and unsettling film essay on forestry practices in the Pacific Northwest, home to the world's tallest trees. Juxtaposing sublime aerial imagery with Vérité workplace footage, he meets people whose livelihood is connected to the forest economy and culture, tempering a critique of neoliberal forestry practices with an up-close understanding for people who labor within the system. The opening weekend of Silvicola will take place at the Cinémathèque Québécois and Cinéma Public, with screenings starting from Friday, March 22nd. For more information, go to cinemapolitica.org/film/Silvicola. We hope to see you there.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Demonstrates yet again the urgent need for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, and the expansion of humanitarian aid into Gaza, as the Security Council demanded in its resolution last week. The resolution must be implemented without delay.
As Israel faces global condemnation over the killing of 7 aid workers from Chef Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen in Gaza, a number of humanitarian groups suspend operations even as Gaza descends into famine. We'll speak with Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. We'll also look at a new Israeli law, which the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu says he'll use to ban Al Jazeera. But first, as Haiti faces spiraling political turmoil, Canada's training Caribbean troops for a Kenyan-led UN mission to Haiti. We'll get an update. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing to face global condemnation over the killing of 7 aid workers from Chef Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen, which had brought food into Gaza by ship to feed starving Palestinians. The aid workers were killed when an Israeli drone fired 3 missiles at the group's clearly marked convoy. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the drone initially struck 1 car in the convoy. Then the drone attacked again after survivors from the first attack got into the second vehicle, which kept driving. After the second strike, the injured passengers were taken to the third car in the convoy, which was then also bombed as it attempted to escape. The attack occurred over a 1.5-mile stretch on a coastal road in Gaza. On Tuesday, Israel admitted to carrying out the airstrike and vowed to investigate. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli attack.
The devastating Israeli airstrikes that killed World Central Kitchen personnel yesterday bring the number of aid workers killed in this conflict to 196, including more than 175 members of our own UN staff. This is unconscionable, but it is an inevitable result of the way the war is being conducted.
The killed aid workers included 3 British nationals, an Australian, a Polish national, an American-Canadian dual citizen, and a Palestinian. President Biden said he was, quote, outraged and heartbroken over the deaths. But at a White House press briefing, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby refused to say if Israel had broken international law.
Is firing a missile at people delivering food and killing them not a violation of international humanitarian law?
Well, Israelis have already admitted that this was a mistake that they made. They're doing an investigation. They'll get to the bottom of this. Let's not get ahead of that. The State Department has a process in place. And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law.
On Tuesday, World Central Kitchen and at least two other groups said they would halt or pause operations in Gaza after the attack. A World Central Kitchen boat, which still held 240 tons of aid on board, left Gaza on Tuesday. Meanwhile, a group of U.S. officials at USAID have privately warned the Biden administration the spread of hunger and malnutrition in Gaza is, quote, unprecedented in modern history, and that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. HuffPost reports the cable states, quote, an immediate and substantial flow of food, health, nutrition and assistance, expanded humanitarian access and safe, unimpeded passage for humanitarian workers is paramount to addressing famine conditions in Gaza, unquote. In Israel, mass protests are continuing against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Tuesday night, Israeli police fired water cannons at protesters who gathered outside Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem. Thousands also protested outside the Knesset.
For 6 months, we're fighting a war and losing it. And I think the only way we can win the war is to have elections and to give the people the opportunity to choose again and to bring the hostages home and to bring the soldiers home. And that's why I'm here.
At the United Nations, Iran has called on the Security Council to take action against Israel for bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus on Monday. The Israeli attack killed 7 Iranian officers, including 3 generals. Zahra Ershadi is Iran's deputy UN ambassador. Primary elections were held Tuesday in Wisconsin, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New York. On the Democratic side, a sizable number of voters refused to back Joe Biden to protest his support for Israel's assault on Gaza. In Connecticut and Rhode Island, more than 10% of Democrats voted uncommitted. In Wisconsin, over 8% voted uninstructed. Meanwhile, Donald Trump won every Republican race on Tuesday, but Nikki Haley still received about 13% of the vote in Connecticut, New York, and Wisconsin, even though she suspended her campaign. The White House was forced to cancel its planned Ramadan dinner after many Muslim American leaders refused to go to protest Biden's Gaza policy. Instead of a dinner, Biden held a scaled-back meeting Tuesday with Muslim American community figures, but that, too, was met with protest. The Palestinian-American Dr. Thara Mohammed, who recently volunteered in Gaza, walked out of the White House meeting after giving President Biden a letter from an 8-year-old orphaned Palestinian girl named Hadil that read, quote, I beg you, President Biden, stop them from entering Rafah. Dr. Thara Ahmed spoke to Middle East Eye after walking out of the White House.
You cannot engage and try to get us to come out and show up in the primaries or in November, at the same time approving billions of dollars of 2,000-pound bombs that I personally saw devastate Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah and all the areas in Gaza. That sort of cognitive dissonance is not something that is just our community glosses over.
Senegal's new president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, has named Ousmane Sonko to be his prime minister, capping a remarkable 3-week period that saw the two opposition figures going from prison to ruling Senegal. Faye and Sonko were released from prison in mid-March, just days before Faye won Senegal's election to replace President Macky Sall, who'd attempted to delay the vote. On Tuesday, Faye was officially inaugurated as Senegal's new president.
Le Sénégal sous mon magistère.
Under my leadership, Senegal will be a country of hope, a country at peace, with an independent justice system and a strengthened democracy. This is my promise, based on the oath I have just taken before God and the nation in your presence. I am aware that the results of the ballot box express a profound desire for systemic change. Through my election, the Senegalese people have committed themselves to building a fair Senegal, a prosperous Senegal, a progressing Africa.
Faye is the youngest president in Africa. A mayoral candidate in Mexico was assassinated Monday at a campaign event in the city of Celaya in the state of Guanajuato. Berta Gisela Gaetan was shot dead shortly after she outlined her plans to increase security in the city.
The citizens are with us and look after us. Of course, we will have security protocols, which the legal department of the party in the state is reviewing.
Gisela Gaetan was a member of the ruling Morena Party. The Associated Press reports at least 15 political candidates have been killed in Mexico since January, ahead of nationwide elections on June 2nd. Taiwan's been hit with the largest earthquake in 25 years. At least 9 people have died, over 800 are injured. The 7.4 magnitude quake toppled dozens of buildings and trapped at least 77 people. In other news from the region, President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke Tuesday for an hour and 45 minutes on the phone. It was their first call since a summit in November. Donald Trump's former lawyer, John Eastman, has been disbarred in California for his role in trying to help Trump overturn the 2020 election. A California judge wrote in her ruling, quote, "Eastman's wrongdoing constitutes exceptionally serious ethical violations warranting severe professional discipline," unquote. Eastman is a former law school dean at Chapman University School of Law. In educational news, Pitzer College in Claremont, California, has closed its study abroad program with the University of Haifa in Israel in what's being viewed as a major victory for the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. The move comes after years of student organizing and a vote in February by Pitzer Student Senate to suspend all institutional ties with Israeli universities. According to the National Chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, Pitzer has become the first U.S. school to impose an institutional-wide boycott of an Israel study abroad program. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Haiti, where deadly violence continues between armed groups and police in Port-au-Prince. On Tuesday, UN Rights Chief Volker Turk deplored what he called the unprecedented scale of rights abuses in Haiti.
There has been a shocking rise in killings and kidnappings. Sexual violence, particularly targeting women and young girls, is pervasive and very likely to have reached levels not seen before. As the number of people internally displaced rises, over 360,000 now, according to IOM, so too does a further risk of sexual violence as people find themselves away from their homes and their communities. The scale of human rights abuses is unprecedented in modern Haitian history, inflicting a humanitarian catastrophe on an already exhausted people.
The spiraling political turmoil in Haiti appears to have no end in sight. Recently resigned Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who remains locked out of Haiti by armed groups, raised questions this week over the constitutionality of a transitional council, which is being formed to serve as an interim governing body until elections are scheduled. This comes as Canadian forces have been sent to Jamaica to train troops from Jamaica, Belize, and the Bahamas to join the UN-authorized mission to Haiti, led by Kenya. Last week, the UN human rights chief called for an arms embargo on Haiti, calling the situation there cataclysmic. The majority of guns pouring into Haiti are smuggled in from Florida and other parts of the United States. For more, we're joined by two guests. Here in New York, Kim Ives is with us, the editor of the English-language section of the weekly Haiti Liberté, where he's also co-directed the documentary series Another Vision. And in Vancouver, Canada, Jemima Pierre is a Haitian-American scholar, professor at the Social Justice Institute at the University of British Columbia in Canada, and research associate at the University of Johannesburg. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Professor Pierre, there, let's begin with you. Can you just lay out overall the situation at this point in Haiti with a resigned president not able to come back into Haiti? He's condemning a transitional panel to rule Haiti. And this Caribbean group led by Kenya training to move in so-called UN peacekeepers.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me back. What's going on in Haiti are a number of armed groups at first coming together to say that they were working together as an informal coalition. But the violence had been primarily in the Port-au-Prince area. And I have to stress that because the Western media is presenting this as a countrywide civil war and so on, but there are some violence on outside of Port-au-Prince, but the majority of the violence, the gun shooting is actually in the Port-au-Prince area, primarily in the popular neighborhoods and around there. And especially now, where you have some of these groups trying to take over parts, you know, trying to have battles with the police. So that's the first. The second thing that we have to talk about then is this supposed presidential council that the U.S. is putting together using CARICOM as the front-facing party. CARICOM is the Caribbean Communities. Using CARICOM as the front-facing party to basically say that they have a supposedly Haitian-led solution for a transition in Haiti. The problem with that so-called Haitian-led solution is that it's the U.S., France, and Canada, which, as we've known before, are the major forces that have destabilized Haiti, at least in the past 20 years. They're the ones leading the discussion, U.S., France, Canada, Brazil, leading the discussion along with the Caribbean community. As we said before, there needs to be, for the Haitian participation, they have to agree for a multinational security force to come in. Basically, in order to participate in this conversation, you have to be okay with a foreign invasion, which itself is a problem, and basically tells us that the U.S. is controlling the situation. Now, this foreign military force, people will have to remember that it is not a U.N. force. It's UN sanctioned, which is surprising, right? But it is a force that is coming in with absolutely, it's not even clear what its mandate is. There's a 33-page document that talks about the security force, but we don't know what the rules of engagement will be. How will we prosecute the inevitable war crimes that I think will happen when you have foreigners coming in and shooting at a population. But the other thing is Canada is training Jamaicans, Bahamians to come in for it, as if they're coming into a war zone. And that itself bodes badly for us for people in Haiti. And so I think this is a terrible situation in the sense that what's happening in Port-au-Prince is a result of guns being brought into the country from the U.S., Dominican Republic, and Jamaica. But the other thing is that whatever solution that the U.S. is having is a completely inadequate and unconstitutional and illegal solution. And even the military force that the U.S. is trying to bring in, we have to remember they tried to get Brazil to lead it, Canada to lead it. They all said no. That force itself is not constitutional because it was asked by an illegitimate government, Ariel Henry, from 2022. So it's a terrible situation. But I think the idea that this is there's a Haitian-led solution coming is actually a false one and one that is misleading.
And Professor Pierre, I wanted to ask you about this transitional council. It's supposedly been meeting now for several weeks, and nothing seems to have come out of it. How is even the decision making of this council? Is that transparent? Is it by vote, by consensus? And could you talk a little bit more about the council?
Well, we don't know much about the council, and it's not transparent. These are supposedly negotiations happening between CARICOM and especially the Guyanese president, who and you know, who has been very belligerent about these members of this community, the Haitians that they've chosen to participate in this discussion, that they have to agree to this multinational mission. Apparently, they came up with this, you know, members of the council has have been chosen. Some people dropped out in terms of leadership. The council's made up of people chosen by the U.S., members of the political class, the old political class that people really don't want to have anything to do with, but key members of that. And there's infighting amongst them. But recently, just I think a few days ago, the president of Guyana sent a letter to Ayo Henry to get his permission to ratify this transitional council, which itself should tell us everything we need to know. The fact that this ousted illegal, illegitimate prime minister has to have a say in this transitional council. So I'm not sure, you know, at first they were saying that they were giving them 48 hours to come up with a council to allow this transition. And the U.S. thinks it needs this council in order to make it seem like a military force coming into Haiti is legitimate. But I'm not sure how far we're going to get with that because, you know, I think for Haitian people, this is a completely obscure process that leaves regular people out of the discussion.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Kim Ives of AT Liberté. Kim, you recently helped an American YouTube personality there, Addison Pierre Malouf, who was kidnapped, obtain his release. Could you talk about what happened there and your sense of what's going on in Haiti?
Yes, Juan. This was a YouTuber who went down and thought he was just going to drive from Cape Haitien, where he'd flown into, down to Port-au-Prince and interview Jimmy Cherizier, known as Barbecue. And he was kidnapped along the way. He spent 17 days in jail. He paid some ransom, or his family paid some ransom, friends. And once they paid, they weren't released. The kidnappers wanted more. And that's when they published the thing last Friday. Dan Cohen, the co-director of Another Vision, and myself saw this come up on the radar and immediately called Cherizier and said, "What's going on? I thought you guys were stopping. You were going to shut down the kidnappers." And he said, "Let me get on it." And a few days later, he managed to convince or pressure L'Amour Saint-Jour, the kidnapper, to release your fellow Arab, as this YouTuber is called. And so, yeah, it was, I could say, a victory for the Vive Ensemble coalition that Cherizier has put together, which is basically his anti-crime groups versus the former criminal groups, which are supposed to be dropping it. But as we can see, they're still doing some kidnapping.
Can you talk more about—go ahead, Juan.
No, I was just going to ask him about this issue of what we hear in the media is that these are all criminal gangs that are operating, but you have a different perspective on that. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on the distinctions that you've tried to make with some of these gang groups or these paramilitary groups, really.
Sure, completely. This is a revolutionary process we're watching unfold in Haiti. These are basically armed neighborhood committees. Some of them have gone down a criminal road. Others are fighting against the criminals. And as a result, the U.S. is afraid of this because the anti-criminal groups led by Cherizier have a revolutionary agenda. They want to change the system in Haiti. They want to overthrow it. And the U.S. flagged him as a danger early on. We have been looking into him carefully over the past 4 years and seeing that he's the genuine article as far as we can see. And they're trying to always demonize the Haitian people. They did this in a century ago in 1915 when Charlemagne Peralt organized what were at that time also considered bandits, the Cacos, who had been sort of rural ruffians who would ride into Port-au-Prince and overthrow a government and that sort of thing. But he forged them into a guerrilla force which fought the U.S. Marine occupation of 1915 that landed, was in the country till 1934. And they were all called bandits. So you always have to demonize, criminalize the people's resistance. And that's what we're seeing today when they tried to put all the armed groups of the Haiti's popular classes into one bag called the gangs.
Kim, I wanted to go to a documentary series you did in 2022 called Another Vision that tells the story of Barbecue, of Jimmy Charizier and the revolutionary forces of the G9 family and allies. Let's go to a clip.
You're sick, Dad? What do you have? You have pain? A pain in your leg?
I can't even stand up.
You can't stand up? Did you go to the hospital? Why didn't you go to the hospital?
I have no money. I have nothing.
You have no money to go to the hospital?
No.
Okay. I'm going to finish doing this video to show the entire world the conditions you are living in. This is a person, a Haitian born and raised nappy hair, a child of Dessalines, same as me, where a group of men have taken the country hostage and joined with a bunch of politicians, and they've reduced the people to the misery they're living in today.
So that's Barbecue, Jimmy Charizier, talking to a man in a flooded-out area, very poor neighborhood. Talk about why he got the name Barbecue and what you see happening right now. Professor Pierre was saying, why is Ariel Henry even weighing in now? Hadn't he resigned? And it was Charizier who demanded, along with the other armed groups, that he not come back and that he did resign.
Yeah, well, Charizier is the one responsible for keeping Ariel out after finally getting Ariel out of power, as almost all of Haiti had been demanding over the past 3 years. Essentially, just to go to your first question, he got the name Barbecue because in his neighborhood growing up, there were three Jimmys, and they would give each one the nickname of what their parent did, and his mom sold barbecued meat, so he became Jimmy Barbecue. But this has been spun by the disinformation agents to be that he burns people alive and this sort of thing. They've been trying to demonize him all along. But this uprising is basically threatening this political class. The U.S. has been was using Ariel Henry, and they were holding on to him too long. It's hard to shift horses when you're galloping down the road of towards disaster, and so they were loath to leave Ariel until they absolutely had to. And finally, that came on February 29th when Charizier more or less put together all the armed groups of Port-au-Prince, even the criminal groups that he's been fighting for 4 years, and basically said, you cannot land at the airports. And the people in OCAP, which was the only other airport where Ariel could have landed, also organized to block his plane landing there. So he was out. The U.S. had to shift, but they created this seven-headed monster, which everybody's shocked at, and all its members have discredited themselves, completely disgraced themselves.
You mean this transitional council?
This transitional council, because they had to agree to a foreign military intervention. Now, Haiti just finished with a foreign military intervention only 5 years ago. In 2019 was the end of the Minijust, which followed on the MINUSTAH, 13 years of MINUSTAH. So you had 15
UN peacekeeping forces.
Right. The first, after Aristide was overthrown by the U.S., the U.S. installed the MINUSTAH, which was, again, a cheaper-priced military force to occupy Haiti for 13 years, from 2004 to 2017. And then from 2017 to 19, they had a sort of wind-down force called the MINUSJUST. So 2019 is when MINUSJUST left. And here we are 4 years later, back in the same problem. This is not a problem that can be solved with military force. This is a socioeconomic problem, as Charizier is always saying. People need to eat. They need schools, hospitals, roads, sanitation, electricity, internet. They need the basics of life. And this is what he has been fighting for. And this is you know, the essence of any of these revolutions, which we've seen throughout history. I mean, the Bolsheviks had their revolution on the basis of land, peace, and bread. So the people are demanding change, and right now, this political class, which basically the oligarchy was using the criminal gangs to attack Cherizier. They've been fighting for the past 4 years. Now, Cherizier has taken them, or tried to take them, into some kind of alliance. We'll see how long it lasts. It's a little bit, you have to think, like Mao Zedong with Chiang Kai-shek in the early 40s to drive out the Japanese from China. He had to ally with some of his bitterest enemies, but they succeeded. So we'll see how far the Vivre Ensemble coalition gets. It's going to be a messy process, as revolutions always are.
Professor Pierre, I'd like to get your take on the situation and also the Kim Ives analysis that some of these armed groups have revolutionary potential or attempting a revolution.
Well, the truth is, well, not the truth, but part of my the reality is a lot of people I haven't seen that. So part of it is, it is a controversial take from Kim, who I respect. I do think I'm actually a lot more agnostic about what's going on in terms of these armed groups and what they will end up doing at this in the future. But at this point, a lot of people in the popular neighborhoods and so on and so forth see these armed groups as the groups that have really impacted their lives in the poor neighborhoods, and they see them as people who are getting arms and money from the oligarch, from the political elite, and so they don't necessarily make that distinction. And so, you know, my point of view is that you know, if this is a revolution, we're waiting for it to actually come to fruition. But in the meantime, what's happening are a lot of people that are being displaced, and that are seeing that their biggest foe are these armed groups that a lot of them mix together as one, because what they see, you know, what they feel are bullets, what they hear are bullets, and what they see is they're living in a space where there's a lot of violence and a lot of pain. And so then if there's a revolution, there needs to be a particular kind of ideology that takes over the entire country, and that remains to be seen.
We're going to have to leave it there, but of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. Jemima Pierre, Haitian American scholar, professor at the Social Justice Institute at the University of British Columbia in Canada, research associate also at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. Her recent article for NACLA is headlined Haiti as Empire's Laboratory. And Kim Ives, editor of the English language section of the weekly Haiti Liberté. Next up, we go to Jan Egeland in Oslo, Norway, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, as Israel faces global condemnation over the killing of 7 aid workers from the World Central Kitchen in Gaza. Some humanitarian groups are suspending operations in Gaza, even as it descends into famine. Stay with us. Music by Nawar al-Nadaf. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel's facing global condemnation over the killing of 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen who'd brought food into Gaza by ship to feed starving Palestinians. The aid workers were killed when an Israeli drone fired 3 missiles at the group's clearly marked convoy, even though the charity had coordinated the convoy's route with the Israeli military. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the Israeli attack.
The devastating Israeli airstrikes that killed World Central Kitchen personnel yesterday bring the number of aid workers killed in this conflict to 196, including more than 175 members of our own UN staff. This is unconscionable, but it is an inevitable result of the way the war is being conducted.
The killed aid workers included 3 British nationals, an Australian, a Polish national, an American-Canadian dual citizen, and a Palestinian. In a video address, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed Israel attacked the convoy.
Unfortunately, in the last day, there was a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people in the Gaza Strip. This happens in wartime. We are thoroughly looking into it, are in contact with the foreign governments of those killed, and will do everything to ensure it does not happen again.
This happens in wartime. Meanwhile, President Biden said he was, quote, outraged and heartbroken over the deaths. But at a White House press briefing, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby refused to say if Israel had broken international law.
Is firing a missile at people delivering food and killing them not a violation of international humanitarian law?
Well, Israelis have already admitted that this was a mistake that they made. They're doing an investigation. They'll get to the bottom of this. Let's not get ahead of that.
The State Department has a process in place. And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law.
On Tuesday, Chef Jose Andres's World Central Kitchen and at least 2 other groups said they would pause operations in Gaza after the attack. Meanwhile, HuffPost reports a group of U.S. officials at USAID have privately warned the Biden administration the spread of hunger and malnutrition in Gaza is unprecedented in modern history and that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. For more, we go to Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Oslo, Norway. Jan, thanks for joining us again. Can you start off by responding to the Israeli airstrike on the 3-car convoy that killed 7 international aid workers?
It was horrific. And remember, this was targeted. It was repeated attacks. First one car, then the next car, then the 3rd car, and a couple of the cars were targeted several times. It's not likely that the Israelis wanted to kill the colleagues from World Central Kitchen. World Central Kitchen had worked closely with the Israeli forces to get out support to Palestinians in northern Gaza. But they surely hit cars that they did not know what was inside. And that's the story of this war. So when the State Department say we cannot see any violations of humanitarian law, they haven't read the humanitarian law, because there has to be precaution. There has to be distinction between military and civilians, and there has to be proportionality. And after thousands of dead children, thousands of dead women, all completely innocent of the 7th of October, hundreds of doctors, hundreds of nurses, hundreds of teachers, and 200 humanitarian workers before the international workers were killed, it's very clear that this has been a disproportionate response to what happened, the horrors of the 7th of October, in violation of international law, every day, basically, since mid-October.
Jan Egeland, in that vein, I'd like to ask you, excuse me, about a a recent report in the Observer over the weekend in England that a member of Parliament, Alicia Kearns, a Conservative Party member and the chair of the House of Commons Select Committee, was at a fundraiser, and there was a leaked tape of her remarks there. And she said on that leaked tape that the British Foreign Office has received official legal advice that Israel has broken international humanitarian law, but that the government has not announced it and has kept it quiet. I'm wondering, especially in view of the fact that three British nationals were killed in this latest attack, your response to the fact that the British government is hiding the fact that its own lawyers have said Israel is violating international law?
Well, I just met Alicia Kearns in London, and she's a very fine politician. She went to Rafah. She saw all of the trucks that were lining up, not able to go in to Gaza. She wrote letters about that to both the UK government, and she approached the Israelis. I mean, she is really engaged on this, as so many others have become, as they see the injustice in what's happening to the population of Gaza. Whether the UK government is concealing advice on this, I cannot say, but the facts speaks for themselves. If you have a conflict where there is a world record in killing protected categories of personnel, then the law is broken, you know, to pieces. There's no other way to see it.
I wanted to go to a tweet where you said the U.S., the U.N., the EU, and the rest of the world agree that we're at the brink of famine in northern Gaza. Still, only 159 trucks were allowed into Gaza yesterday, and Israel blocks all food convoys from UNRWA to reach north Gaza. There must be accountability for this. Then you go on in another tweet to say the horrific targeted repeated attack that killed seven WCK aid workers follow nearly 200 Palestinian humanitarians killed by Israel's military campaign. Now, finally, Western governments providing arms to the killing say enough. Immediate ceasefire ending the killing of civilians, protection scheme that guarantees safety for humanitarian work, opening of land crossings for massive aid to the north, ending chaotic air and sea delivery, no military invasion of the world's largest refugee camp, Rafah. You tweeted that. In the United States, President Biden talked about being heartbroken, but as the New York Times reports, Biden administration is pressing Congress on $18 billion sale of F-15 jets to Israel. This follows a deal made with F-35 jets and many 2,000-pound bombs and 500-pound bombs. Can you respond to the U.S. and other countries supplying these weapons at this point to Israel?
Well, my own country, Norway, a NATO country, has refrained from sending arms to Israel for quite some time. So has many other countries. It is really mind-boggling if the U.S. now sends these large bombs that are by nature indiscriminate to a place with so many thousands of dead children. Are they not thinking of the consequences for their moral authority in the rest of the world? What does this mean for the West's arguments in Ukraine? If it's wrong, as it is, for Russia to occupy Ukrainian territory, kill Ukrainian civilians, target Ukrainian infrastructure, how could it possibly be correct when the Israelis do the same to the Palestinians and with U.S. arms?
And Jan Edlin, I'd like to ask you, your organization, like others that provide assistance in Gaza, have to coordinate your activities, obviously, with the Israeli military. What does this latest attack mean for those future efforts when clearly even organizations that coordinate closely with the military so that they are not attacked end up being still attacked?
Well, we have coordinated with Israel now for many years. I was myself in Gaza, traveled to Rafah and traveled around in Rafah, and we sought permission, as we have to, by Israel. Israel control everything going in and everyone going into Gaza. And we also coordinated my movements there. Nothing happened to me. Nothing really has happened to our NRC convoys aid operation. But we are largely in the southern third of Gaza, where the majority of the Palestinians are. I think the whole thing shows the horrific killing of seven of our colleagues in the World Central Kitchen that I know well. I saw their good operations. I ate one of their meals when I was in Rafah. It was a very good meal. And the Palestinians, whom they feed millions of meals every day, rely on this. I think what's happened will lead to a reboot of the system for protection for humanitarian work. The US, UK, Germany, and others cannot live with a war machine out of control that is sort of targeting cars without knowing what's inside, as they did in this case and in multiple other cases. So I think there will be a new and better deconfliction or notification system, coordination system, there are many names of it, for them, even in the northern parts of Gaza, where it has been most dangerous.
The World Central Kitchen boat still had 240 tons of food on board the boat. It left Gaza Tuesday. The WCK says they're suspending operations. Other groups say that. What about the Norwegian Refugee Council? And can you talk about this in conjunction with the defunding of UNRWA, the kind of umbrella that facilitates all of this, what this means as the region descends, the strip descends into famine?
Yeah, World Central Kitchen is withdrawing. So are some other groups, which is terrible, because they were important for our collective efforts to avoid famine in Gaza. NRC, my own Norwegian Refugee Council, we're not leaving. We are continuing to work today and tomorrow. We have, however, suspended some of our movements, and we're not going north for the time being, because it's considered too difficult, too dangerous. Israel is not allowing conditions for that, and it's in the north, the remaining population there, that is engulfed in the worst famine. UNRWA is the backbone, really, of social services for the Palestinians. It was created by the United States and the other original members of the United Nations when Israel was created, and it led to the Nakba and hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA was created by all of us to take care of the Palestinians that were suffering because of the Holocaust in Europe and the creation of Israel. Since then, UNRWA has become essential in Gaza. They are much bigger than all of the others combined, NRC, the other UN agencies, World Central Kitchen, etc., etc., etc. We're not even half of what UNRWA is. So when the U.S. Congress and the Biden administration says, we're not going to give you money, and so was a number of other donors, because of allegations, no evidence provided, allegations that some of these 13,000 staff, a dozen, dirty dozen, perhaps participating in the horrors of the 7th of October. You can't believe that our very own donors make it difficult for us to help the Palestinian population. UNRWA is essential. UNRWA needs to be funded. Stop the games with politicizing aid to children.
Do you think the U.S. should stop weapons sales and weapons transfers to Israel?
I cannot see any nation giving arms to any war where there are these kind of casualties among children, women, aid workers, journalists, colleagues of you, Amy, are killed in mass in Gaza. No, yeah, of course they shouldn't give arms to that. That's, they could have their fingerprints all over a crime scene.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Next up, we look at a new Israeli law, which Prime Minister Netanyahu says he will use to ban Al Jazeera. Stay with us. Go to Heaven by Shabaka and the Ancestors. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Press freedom groups are denouncing plans by Israel to ban the award-winning TV network Al Jazeera. On Monday, Israeli lawmakers passed a bill allowing for the temporary banning of foreign broadcasters they deem to be a national security threat. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wrote on social media, quote, Al Jazeera harmed Israel's security, actively participated in the October 7th massacre, and incited against Israeli soldiers. It's time to remove the bullhorn of Hamas from our country, he tweeted. Al Jazeera, which is funded by the Qatari government, is the most widely viewed network in the Arab world, is one of the few outlets to have reporters inside Gaza. Mohammed Mawad, the managing editor for Al Jazeera's Arabic channel, denounced Israel's move to ban the network.
This move, alleging Al Jazeera of siding with the terrorists, is baseless. It's alarming. Our work is we upheld the highest standards of journalistic professionalism. Al Jazeera has been there in Israel and in the Palestinian territories covering the war from both sides. Our work is corroborated and has been corroborated by so many outlets around the world. The fact that we are on the ground, covering from the field, giving voice to the voiceless, bringing this account, which is not available on any other outlet, having correspondents covering from North Gaza, reporting on the starvation there, is very important. And I think the Israeli government is feeling pressure by our coverage. But what we are doing is try to give voice to the voiceless and try and make sure that the suffering of civilians on the ground is heard by the entire world.
That was Mohammed Mawad, the managing editor for Al Jazeera's Arabic channel. For more, we go to London. We're joined by Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Thanks so much for joining us again, Daniel. Start off by responding to what this means and what Netanyahu is threatening.
Netanyahu has passed a law, it's now law in Israel, that Al Jazeera cannot broadcast. How that is implemented, is equipment taken, are people arrested, are vendors who work with Al Jazeera unable to do so? That has not played out yet, Amy. That applies to Israel-occupied East Jerusalem-occupied West Bank. Gaza, which is a war zone, the Al Jazeera work was not in any way dealing with Israeli vendors or the Israeli system, of course. And we're seeing, at this stage still, Al Jazeera reports coming out of both spaces. But Netanyahu has passed this law. It's important to note that not a single Zionist member of the Knesset voted against the law. If we remember before October 7th, there were these big protests, save Israeli democracy from Netanyahu. Well, none of the opposition parties that are Zionist chose to oppose this law, which the Association for Civil Rights in Israel has called political, not security-related, and a dangerous challenge to freedom of the press and freedom of expression, the two parties representing Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel did vote against in that parliamentary vote.
And Daniel Levy, what evidence is there, if any, that, as the government says, that Al Jazeera actively participated in the October 7th attack?
Well, there is none whatsoever. Israel has not presented any evidence. It hasn't really intended to do so. What's going on here? Prime Minister Netanyahu, in part, is playing to a domestic political audience. He has set Qatar, he has set Al Jazeera up to be a figure of hate. Israelis are not being shown in their own media, a whole different world of problems, the level of censorship and self-censorship inside the Israeli media. So this is red meat to his own base, to the domestic politics, in a situation in which the war is not going particularly well for Israel. He's looking for distractions. I think other things that are going on here is, of course, that he doesn't want these images and this message to come out. We saw that in May 2021, Israel bombed the media tower in Gaza, the Al Jalla Tower, where Al Jazeera and AP and others had their offices. We remember just under 2 years ago, Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by the Israeli forces. We know that approximately 100 journalists, the family of the major Al Jazeera correspondent, Wael Dakhdouch himself injured, his family killed. So these people have been killed. And I think another piece of this is Netanyahu going not just against Al Jazeera, but trying to push back. And it's part of his effort against Qatar. The Israelis run an aggressive campaign against Qatar in the US and elsewhere. Qatar is mediating these talks. They've met with members of the families of the hostages. They are involved with the head of the CIA and with the head of the Israeli Mossad. But Netanyahu has systematically and frequently tried to undercut and undermine these negotiations. And this is another example of him doing so. And how can he get away with this? It's the same as the story of World Central Kitchen. It's the same as how come this has created the worst hunger crisis anywhere in the world, according to the UN Secretary General. The number of Palestinian civilian deaths, UN workers, aid workers, because he can get away with it, because the United States, his major backer and defender, continues to provide the arms and the weapons, the latest including 2,000-pound bombs.
So your comment on this, do you think the U.S. should cut off the arms flow to Israel? I mean, this is very significant coming from you. You're an advisor to past prime ministers. You're a peace negotiator under two prime ministers of Israel. Do you think the U.S. should cut off the arms flow?
I think it depends, Amy. If the administration want to continue to see civilian deaths at an astronomical scale, a humanitarian catastrophe unparalleled, more than three times the number of children, according to Save the Children, killed in this conflict in Gaza, as are killed in every conflict around the world in an entire year. If they want to continue to see that level of destruction, if they want to continue to see U.S. complicity in that, the U.S. violating the provisional measures of the International Court of Justice, the U.S. being the prime violator of international law rather than its upholder, then go ahead and continue to provide those offensive, destructive, horrific weapons. If, by contrast, the U.S. wants to be within the law and wants to end this war, and by the way, to successfully advance the negotiations to get a ceasefire and to get the hostages out, if that's the goal of the Biden administration, stop telling me you're heartbroken. Stop telling me this is so sad. We're talking to the Israelis. They should do it differently. Let's work out how to do Rafah. Stop telling me that Netanyahu is a problem. You're the problem, because you're the enabler, you're the facilitator. Every single day that you continue to back this horrendous war, which is tragic for Palestinians, and I would argue doing nothing to advance Israeli security either, in fact, quite the opposite, and which now risks a broader regional escalation and conflagration after the latest provocation in Syria by Israel.
And Daniel Levy, I wanted to ask you about that. We have only about a minute, but the this latest provocation that you talked about, the attack in Syria, do you sense that Netanyahu, given the deep unpopularity that he has and the massive protests against him, is even willing to escalate this conflict more to be able to maintain his power?
It's a crucial question, and I don't see how we can't take that very seriously. We have to take that seriously. He's bombed a diplomatic compound. He's done something which was clearly escalatory and a new level of provocation. Will Iran, Hezbollah maintain the kind of strategic patience that they've shown? Will there be pressure on this? There's clearly not pressure to save Palestinian civilians, but is this where there might be pressure? I think we have to take very seriously that Prime Minister Netanyahu needs this war to continue and is willing and has already gone to extreme lengths to do so. There is a protest movement in Israel, not unfortunately against the war, but to prioritize getting a deal for the hostage release. We need everyone to lean into that, which requires real leverage and a real cost for Israel for continuing on this devastating path.
Daniel Levy, we want to thank you for being with us, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'll also be in Berkeley celebrating KPFA's 75th anniversary, the first Pacifica radio station. That's Saturday night, April 6th. Go to our website at democracynow.org. That's it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of her say. The voice of her say. The voice of her say, coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take out T-C-T.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.